Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f- So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Is time running out for pensions tax relief? The Chancellor, Sajid Javid, is reported to be considering a major shake-up of this £40 billion tax break at the budget in a month's time. The FT's Jo Cumbo is here to give her views on what form this could take. And while we're on the theme of budget savings, what about the £2 billion cost of paying the winter fuel allowance? Worth up to £300 per year to most pensioners, this universal benefit is paid whether you're a millionaire or in genuine fuel poverty. The think tank, the Social Market Foundation, has come up with an alternative solution. And seeing as we're going with the theme of worry this week, well, what about house prices? There has been some positive sentiment in recent surveys, but our resident property guru James Pickford has been looking at how the next property cycle could turn out. Welcome to The Money Show, the FT's weekly podcast about personal finance and investing. I'm Claire Barrett, FT Money Editor, bringing you all of this week's money news. The £40 billion cost of pensions tax relief is in the Treasury sights ahead of the budget next month, with reports that the Chancellor is considering scrapping higher rates of relief for Britain's wealthiest. This could generate a potential £10 billion annual saving, but of course if it goes ahead, it would hit the retirement plans of millions of savers and horrify the Conservative Party's core voters. Joining me now is Josephine Cumbo, the FT's pensions correspondent. So Jo, the problem with pensions tax relief is that the wealthy are the ones who benefit the most from it.
Yes, tax relief is given to us to incentivise us to lock away our money for the long term. But currently, the lion's share of those £40 billion worth of tax relief, the tax incentives, are going to the best paid in the country and arguably not those who need it most to help build up an adequate pot for retirement. So, as you said, the current bill to the Treasury from pension tax relief, or the loss of upfront income taxes, around £40 billion a year. And that includes employers not having to pay national insurance contributions on what they pay into a pension on behalf of their employee.
Mm-hmm.
Currently, the system works so that you get upfront tax relief on what you pay into a pension, with this tax relief given at the same rate you pay tax. So if you're a basic rate taxpayer, you get 20% relief on your contributions and 40% if you're a higher earner. Now, of course, there are separate rates in Scotland which apply on income tax and pension tax relief. But basic rate taxpayers currently make up more than half of the total contributions into pensions each year, but only receive a third of tax relief apportioned. So around two-thirds of the relief goes to higher earners. So you can see the ratio there is very much skewed to higher earners. But on the surface, even though the system does look as though the higher earners are benefiting disproportionately, we must point out that tax is recouped when those pensions are paid. And last year, in 2017-18, the last figures that we have, around $18 billion was received by the government on pensions in payments. So the system, the government does get some of that tax back, but not enough to sort of counter what they're paying out currently. So if there was a removal of high rate relief, what it would result in is higher earners are paying more tax. Their tax bills are going to increase or their pension pots aren't going to grow as fast. So, yes, understandably, there will be some protests from higher earners about changes to the current system.
Well, certainly there was shock and awe in the comments underneath your piece last weekend. But in the days that have followed that, how likely do you think it is that the Chancellor will announce such a big shake-up at the budget next month?
I think there is a real reasonable chance that we will see changes in the budget because Treasury insiders have confirmed to the FT that the Chancellor is considering reforms that would hit the better off and ease pressure on strained public finances. And pensions tax relief is low-hanging fruit in that area. Now, we know pensions tax relief is one of the areas under scrutiny. Restricting tax relief on pension contributions to 20% compared with 40% enjoyed by high-rate taxpayers could raise around £10 billion extra a year for the Chancellor. So this does look rather tempting. Now, the Treasury has yet to reach a final decision on what will be included in the March 11 budget. It's really important to say that there haven't been anything sort of decided as yet, but it will be a real test of whether the Prime Minister is willing to increase taxes on traditional Tory voters, including millions in the party's Southern England heartlands, to help new Conservative supporters in the North.
Oh, yes, the levelling up. Well, I mean, the last time such radical plans for pensions were mooted was under George Osborne. And, you know, a few years ago, there was talk of replacing pensions with a pensions ISA or a single flat rate of around 30%. Now, do you think either of those plans could yet be reheated?
The last time the government considered major changes in 2016, there was a consultation on turning pensions into ISA-style taxed savings vehicles and a single rate of tax of around 30%, basically one tax for all. Now, these were major changes to the system that would require a big shake-up. The government did not proceed with the changes at the time because there was a lack of consensus. A lot of that was driven by Tory backbenchers really worried and concerned about a backlash from their voters because it would result in the loss of high rate tax relief, and they just were not keen on doing it. So that plan didn't go anywhere. But I think the political situation has changed somewhat now with the government being in a commanding position in terms of the majority they have in Parliament. They've got 80 seats in advance, so they're in a better position to push through radical changes. And of course, what I mentioned a couple of minutes ago, they've got a change in their voter base now. They're not just backed by traditional Tory voters in their heartlands. They've got a different voter base to consider now. So if they were going to consider something more radical, such as switching or getting rid of high rate relief, I think now would be the opportune time to have a go at it.
But probably more likely to announce a review or a consultation rather than make any sudden change.
I think that there would be a review because these changes are so massive that they couldn't do a pension freedom style announcement and push ahead with anything, that they would have to get the industry's opinion and from broadly from the community about how they would be impacted.
And finally, the other big nightmare for the Chancellor when it comes to pensions is the taper, which has produced some very unintended consequences in the NHS, as you've been reporting. What are your thoughts on that?
The Chancellor has pledged to announce or unveil a solution to this problem, which has been dogging the NHS and leading to patients waiting longer for surgery and for treatment. And that's got to do with doctors getting big tax bills for working overtime. And that comes back to changes the government has made to the annual allowance, specifically the introduction of the tapered annual allowance. Now, this affects not just NHS doctors, but all higher earners in the private sector as well. The government has stalled on fixing this problem because they've wanted to contain it to the NHS. They haven't wanted to get rid of this taper or the changes to the annual allowance, which are drawing in a lot of money for them, a lot of savings in terms of tax revenue. So there has been one idea floated, and that is to increase the threshold at which the annual allowance taper kicks in for everybody. So that means fewer people would be caught by the annual allowance taper and see their allowance shrink from £40,000 to £10,000, for example. But the doctors' union and a lot of other public sector workers are calling for more wide-scale reform across the sector, or a view of the annual allowances, for example. So I think, given the political situation with the NHS and just more generally calls for reform, that what we could see is just another temporary measure put in place to deal with the NHS, but a consultation launched on more fundamental changes to the system, which might address more wide-scale concerns and challenges about the fairness and the costs of pensions tax relief.
Well, a sticking plaster rather than an amputation of tax relief. Well, thanks very much there to Josephine Cumbo, the FT's pensions correspondent. You can read more on Jo's story now at ft.com/money and check out my column in the Weekend FT this Saturday. Is time running out for pensions tax relief? Is it time to throw the UK's annual winter fuel payments onto the fire. Worth up to £300 a year to some pensioners, regardless of how wealthy they might be, this universal benefit is often more valuable than a free TV licence, and we all know what's happening to those. But a new study from a think tank suggests a bold new approach to the problem. James Kirkup is the director of the Social Market Foundation. He joins me now in the studio. Welcome, James.
Good morning.
So the research that the SMF has done does confirm that the winter fuel allowance is a poorly directed benefit, but it's a problem that previous governments have failed to tackle.
Yeah, I mean, this is a sort of Gordon Brown era policy from a time when there was quite a lot of money in the public finances. The ability, you know, governments could give away money fairly freely, which is exactly what they did. So we now have a situation where, you know, anyone of pensionable age, you know, can qualify. You know, qualifies, gets this payment. And we had a look at the numbers. We found that 20% of the households receiving winter fuel payment have a total income of over £40,000. Now, if you are receiving more than £40,000 in retirement, you're doing pretty well, and you probably don't need, frankly, 200-300 quid from the taxpayer. So we started having a look at what might be done about that. I mean, this has been looked at before. People have explored options for means testing and taxing, and they all run into a combination of political and administrative problems. So, they're hard to sell to voters, and bureaucratically speaking, the DWP tends to say, can't do that, computer says no. So we thought, right, how do we get round these obstacles? And where we end up, in conjunction with our friends at the Rory and Elizabeth Brooks Foundation, is by a system of, we're proposing a system of voluntary forfeiture. Essentially, what we think should happen is that when you get your winter fuel payment, you should have a default option on the form, or the ability to say, actually, you know what, I don't need this. Please just send the money somewhere else. Send it off to some arm's length fund, a good causes fund to be run, ultimately as a public body, but run away from government, that can be used to do good in your community or good around the country, which is sort of our attempt to square several circles involved in this policy.
Well, I was lucky enough to come into your office last week when we had a roundtable debate with lots of people from charitable and political backgrounds. And the sticking point seems to be with this benefit that it is possible, if you are really determined, to opt out of receiving the winter fuel payment. There is something on the DWP's website to do so. But I asked them how many people have actually managed to do this. And the answer for the last tax year was 150 out of around 12 million who are in receipt of the benefit. So what was interesting is that the proposal of, if you don't want it, give it to charity, could maybe elicit more people to give it back than simply unticking a box to say, I don't want it.
Well, our proposal is a combination of the two, in effect, because, I mean, some people say just tax it, essentially find a way of the state keeping this money. Now, bluntly, that's not a very attractive option to a lot of people. If you give someone the option of, you can send this money to a good cause, possibly a good cause of your own or of your own choosing, or you can send it back to the sinking fund. And this is, technically, if you want to return money to the government, you have to check, you write a check to the sinking fund to pay off some of the debts that we began running up in the Napoleonic Wars. It's very hard to give the government money. So this is the attraction, we think, of our proposal, that it, as well as cracking this nut of a slightly poorly targeted universal benefit, it does underpin and encourage philanthropy. It makes it easier for people to send money to good causes. And there are lots of people, we think, who get this money. And quite a lot of them do give it away to charity, but we're essentially about trying to make it easier for them to divert that money to a good cause.
And certainly there are lots of charities who are set up to deal with fuel poverty, which of course isn't just experienced by pensioners, who specifically ask for people to donate their winter fuel payments at around this time of year to help them. Now, huge reaction from the readers online, as you might expect. FT subscriber Get Off Me says that taxing the benefit would be the simplest solution. I have to say he is in line with Sir Steve Webb and Baroness Ros Altman, who both tweeted that they thought it should be added to the state pension and taxed. But he says, that's a far too simple solution, of course, so it won't happen. In the meantime, I will use my fuel allowance to fill up the Land Rover. And another FT subscriber, ABC, says, if every person over a set age is entitled to a winter fuel payment, then every child under a certain age should still be entitled to child benefit. In the UK, I'm made to pay back my two kids' child benefit because I am, in inverted commas, wealthy. What kind of country denies its children money based on either of their parents' income, yet pays money to people to keep warm who could run their heating on full every minute of the day and not even notice the financial impact? I mean, those comments, they're kind of summing up the general view of many readers.
Yeah, I mean, the taxing option, so from Steve Webb and Ros Altman, I mean, it does look simple. I mean, I haven't spoken to either Ros or Steve about this, but I would possibly ask them why it was when they were pensions minister they didn't make that happen. There are answers to that. As it's the politics of it. Also, there's something slightly odd about the spectacle. There would be something slightly odd about the spectacle of the government giving people money and then taking some of that money back in tax. And I know that does happen with the state pension. The state pension is taxed, but there you can just about see how that's justified. If you treat the state income, say if you treat the state pension as a form of earned and deferred income, no one bluntly has earned their winter fuel payment. It is a gift of government, and so taxing it seems a bit odd. And like I say, politically, very tricky. So we're trying. We think there's a happy middle way that can be brought about here.
And finally, James, I've got to ask you: do you think the Chancellor could be hotting up for a big announcement at the budget on this?
We hope so. I mean, we've made our proposals to government and all political parties. I mean, I think and this is part of the reason for doing this. A lot of people in politics on all sides do instinctively realise that some of the big universal benefits, and not just winter fuel payment, triple lock, some of the other policy decisions in this area, are probably not the most rational use of scarce government resources. But they equally know that finding a way of politically untangling that and making reform palatable is very tricky. So obviously, I very much hope that somebody in politics, we are a cross-party think tank, ideas open to all, will pick this up and run with it. And I will continue to make the case wherever I can.
Well, thanks very much there to James Kirkup, Director of the Social Market Foundation. You can read my column now, inspired by the SMF's research, Winter Fuel Payments, Time to Throw Them on the Fire, on ft.com/money. Timing the property cycle right plays a central role in whether property owners and investors make money when buying or selling a home, but what forces determine where prices are going next? New research exploring the price gap that's opened up between London and the rest of the UK shows that the property cycle is going through a pivotal stage, and the FT's James Pickford is here to tell us more. Welcome, James.
Thank you.
So this research that you've written about, what does it tell us about how the property cycle works?
Well, it's quite interesting that the estate agent Savills did some research where they looked at all the local authorities in England and Wales, and they matched up those where the house price changes were most closely correlated. And basically they came up with 13 different groups, not always in the same area, just about the closeness of the ups and downs in prices, not the absolute values of the houses. So the places that move most closely together, you have these 13 groups, and it does seem to, as one might expect, spread in a sort of wave-like form from central London and out. And just to give you a sense of what is in these groups, they put some quite nice characterised names on them. So you have wealthy Metroland, which is, I think, number three, which is St Albans, Wokingham, Windsor, those sort of commuting, core commuting areas. Then you have fringe commute, places like Chichester, Bristol and Bath, which are, you'd have to probably struggle to get into London every day from there, but they do well in property terms. And then at the very bottom, you have the challenged northern towns, which is the name they've given to places like Blackburn, Burnley, Hartlepool. And if you look over 25 years, the top group house prices have gone up by 628% versus 192% in the bottom group. And that doesn't take into account, that's not adjusting for inflation. So those are the sort of headline figures. But what's quite interesting is if you take those groups and you look at the previous property cycle, which started it ran for basically 10 years from 1995, you find this classic effect of leaders and laggards where the top groups suddenly spring out. And you remember at the time it was the internet boom. London was roaring. And you had this 6 years of really strong price growth. Then you had 9/11, you had the Iraq invasion.
The bursting of the internet bubble.
That's right, the bursting of the internet bubble. And London suddenly flattened off. At the same time as which Gordon Brown put a huge amount of money into public services in the regions, and employment really took off there, and house prices really took off. So you had some places in the regions with 30% annualised house price growth. And so the regions effectively caught up with London over a 10-year period. There was really not much in it.
But the property cycle now, of course, has changed all of that.
What subsequently happened is more interesting. And that from 2005, we had this soaring of London and the southeast. Punctuated by the financial crisis, but really, even after that, you had an even sharper spike in prices in the south of England. And meanwhile, the regional economies were very much affected by the financial crisis, and house prices struggled there. So at the moment, we had a 3 years, the most recent 3 years.
Since the referendum.
Since the referendum. We have seen a little bit of a reversal of that, where London has stopped growing. Prices in the prime areas are 25% down, up to as much as 25% down since 2014. And you've had quite a lot of tax changes coming in London, particularly affecting the London market, such as buy-to-let and second homes. Stamp duty charges. Whereas in that period, the regional markets have picked up again. But still, the gap between the two is very big. So since 2005, the top two groups in this Savills topology have risen by 125% and 109%, whereas the bottom two have risen by 15% and 17%. So that's quite a big gap to be closed.
A very big gap indeed. But finally, James, what about the Brexit bounce? Are things on the move again since the election?
Well, it's interesting that you know, I mean, the question is, could this gap be closed? And one of the reasons it's worth asking is that Boris Johnson, the new Prime Minister, has of course promised to level up the economy and the great inequalities in the economy. And if it happens that this price change is baked in essentially to house prices from now on, it's going to be quite a lot harder to do that, because people in the south of England will have so much more wealth stored in their housing equity than those in other parts of the country. Whereas if the cycle reimposes itself, then it's much easier for the government to be able to level the economy up. What's happening is that, you know, at the moment there is a bit of that closure, but the experts I've spoken to think you'll be hard pressed to see the gap closed entirely. And in order to do that, so one of them, Richard Donnell from Zoopla, is a researcher at Zoopla, he says that if London was to remain flat, the rest of the country would need to rise in terms of prices by 8%. These are the main cities, actually. This is not everywhere. These are just the main UK cities. In order to get back to the historic average difference. You asked about the Brexit bounce. Yes, there has been a little bit of a change there, which if you're someone that hopes that London will remain flat while the rest of the country catches up, you'll be slightly disheartened by this, because the indicators seem to show that things are picking up again across the country, and that includes in the capital. So you have Rightmove posting its biggest monthly figures for 20 years, and you have figures from HMRC on transaction levels in the last quarter of 2019 showing a sort of 10-year record for the last quarter of that year.
Well, indeed, it does seem like things are restarting again. As ever, if you've got experiences of a property market that you'd like to tell us about, maybe you're trying to sell a house at the moment, or worse, trying to buy one and being outbid on your offer, we would love to hear from you. You can contact us at FT Money on Twitter or email the team money@ft.com. Well, thanks very much to James Pickford there. You can read his piece, Where Are We in the Property Cycle Now, on ft.com/money. That's it for the Money Show this week, but we will be back next Thursday at the usual time. Goodbye.